This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Just how far-reaching are the political consequences of January 6th, and what does 2020 tell us about how future presidential elections could play out? UCF political science lecturer John Hanley says there are big questions about how new voting laws could influence this election cycle and beyond, and what role state legislatures could play in the next presidential election. And he says one thing that January 6th made clear was just how polarized US politics has become. Dr. John Hanley is a political science lecturer at the University of Central Florida. John, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You talked a year ago on national TV about what the January 6th insurrection revealed about the divisions in the United States, and you noted it would take some time for the public to digest what happened. I'm wondering, just reflecting on this a year later, do you feel like you've fully digested the events of that day, and what are you thinking about it now, 12 months on?
Well, I think, you know, we've seen quite a bit more about it. We've seen these prosecutions of the various people who were involved in it. I think some of the perhaps the worst fears that we might have seen, that this was going to be something that was highly coordinated by the former president, haven't really come to pass. And so there's, in some ways, a little bit of a tension between the possibility of something like this happening again and the fact that, you know, there's not really, at this point, a smoking gun that indicates that you really had an effort to really overturn the election that was really, you know, having a lot of push behind it.
January 6th, 2021, and the weeks leading up to it focused a lot more attention than there would normally be on the Electoral College and the role of electors in the presidential election. What do you think the long-term implications of that might be on future presidential elections?
I think there's been some attention to how it works, to the fact that the states do technically get to choose how the electors are going to be allocated. And there is behind it, and something that we haven't really talked about very much in all of this, you know, the possibility of what's called a contingent election, where the election is thrown into the House of Representatives and each state has only one vote, right? So California has as much say in the choice of a president as does Wyoming. And that is really, really a 18th century legacy that really would not fit very well with how we think of our democratic system today. So I think that there's some of this discussion out there.
Mm-hmm.
I think there have been some, you know, efforts, or there's been talk about changing the way that states choose their electors, or the possibility that a state's electors could be chosen by a state legislature, or a state legislature could overturn the choice of the people in the state, or to declare the possibility that there was some sort of fraud. I think, you know, that would be a big step for a state to take.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't had, for the most part, state legislatures choosing electors to the Electoral College really since the 1830s, with a couple of exceptions. And voters like the ability to vote for the president. So I think that would be something that would be very difficult to take away from the electorate. And certainly after an election, it would be difficult to say, well, you know, no, we don't like the way that you did this, so we're going to go in a different direction.
The notion of one state, one vote is an interesting one. And you're right. I don't think there's been much reported on that or even much speculation. But is this something that, you know, scholars of elections and political scientists have been talking about more in the last 12 months, given what happened a year ago?
I think it's something that's out there. It has been, I think, on a, you know, an intellectual and academic level, something that's been out there for quite some time, certainly going back to the 2000 election and Florida's role in that. And there's always this question of what happens if there's a tie in the Electoral College.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's even been kind of explored in television shows. So I think that's out there. And, you know, as academics, as scholars, we're very attuned to the ways in which this Constitution, you know, is an 18th century product and fits the needs and concerns of that day. I think it would take quite a bit more, or a close example of this, for this to really emerge onto the public consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Back to the influence of state legislatures, you know, there were some states where there was a lot more focus on that. Pennsylvania, for example, the role that they play in deciding how, you know, the mechanics of a presidential election plays out. And it sounds like from your point of view, they are not necessarily going to play an outsized role in future elections. But again, that seems to be a fear that some folks may have of, you know, what we saw a year ago was not normal. Therefore, in some ways, the rule book may have been thrown out a little bit. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on, you know, whether we might see a state legislatures playing a different role or a bigger role in future presidential elections. And even if you look at what's happening this year with the midterm elections, if that could presage what we might see in 2024 in some ways.
It's an interesting question because the Constitution says that the electors are chosen in the way that the state legislature says. Mm-hmm. So historically, over a long period of time, we've become accustomed to this system that the state voters get to choose, and they choose in such a way as the person who gets one more vote in the state gets all of the electors of the state. That's normally how it works, with only a couple of exceptions. What opened up, I think, in 2020 was the question of what is meant by state legislature. And that's a kind of advanced constitutional law question. There are some who have said that that allows the state legislature, without the input of the governor, to make those provisions for how the election is going to be conducted, how the electors are going to be allocated. And that constitutionally, I don't think there's traditionally been much behind that. There's this case about redistricting, Arizona State Legislature versus Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission, that deals with the provision of Article 1 of the Constitution that says that state legislatures choose how the elections for Congress are decided. And the issue in that case was that the voters of that state, through an initiative, set up a redistricting commission that excluded the state legislature. And so the question before the Supreme Court was, you know, can the people be determined to be the legislature for this purpose? And the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, said that, well, the people can be the legislature. It means the lawmaking process. One of the problems with that is that two of the justices who were in that 5-4 majority, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Anthony Kennedy, are no longer on the court, and they've been replaced by justices who are considerably more conservative than them. But even Chief Justice Roberts, in that decision, in dissent, said that, well, legislature means the normal legislative process of that state. And if we go back to the time of the founding, the 1780s, where this constitution was put into place, most of the state legislatures or most of the state governments did not have a gubernatorial veto, right? We normally think of the process by which election laws are being made as the state legislature writes the law, the governor signs or vetoes that law. When redistricting plans go through, the governor signs or vetoes those laws as well. And so unless the court takes a step that's considerably away from Chief Justice Roberts, and it may, you know, we've seen some changes in the court moving to away from him even, it would seem that that interpretation would still hold, right? That the governor would still be needed in a change to the election laws, or to go around to end run a vote of the people after the election.
Do you think we're going to see some of these discussions wind up in the Supreme Court?
I think it would really depend on how close the 2024 election is. I think that there's a huge danger for these state legislatures to involve themselves in elections in this way. We saw this in 2020, where the governor and secretary of state in Georgia, you know, really didn't want to be put in the position that they're in. And you're dealing with, by definition, states that are 50-50. They're very, very close. The people who are making these decisions are probably up for re-election in the future. And so they're not going to want to alienate the choice of their states. I think it is possible that we would, however, see that in another close election. Mm-hmm. It would be interesting to see how the Supreme Court would rule on a question like this.
I mean, so much about 2020 was unusual, right? And then leading up to January 6th and thinking about the spotlight that was put on, for example, the Secretary of State in Georgia, that phone call between the president and the president's people and the secretary pretty unusual. I mean, is there some kind of precedent for that in the past?
I don't think you see really, I mean, that is something extraordinary, that level of, you know, presidential pressure, right, is something that you associate more with, you know, a Lyndon Johnson in the office and those, you know, famous videos that you hear of him, or the famous treatment that was meted out to other people in the government, or Richard Nixon. But I don't, you know, you don't get quite to that extent where you have the president, you know, asking for votes or asking something to happen, right? That is an area where he is potentially in legal danger in the state of Georgia. So that's an element that we have not seen a president, you know, brought in on state electoral fraud charges.
Did January 6, 2020 challenge some of what you know and what you believe about how the Electoral College works and how presidential elections are decided?
Not quite. I think that there was very little question that a valid certification of the vote that came in from a state was going to be opened by the vice president. The claims that someone like Vice President Pence could unilaterally decide to reject a certificate, that wasn't really something that very many people at all thought could happen, right? We saw that with Al Gore in 2000 certifying, you know, someone winning over him in a very close election. And we saw that in 1960, where Richard Nixon was the vice president and in an extremely close election validated the victory of John F. Kennedy. So I think in some ways, what January 6th indicates is that the system proceeds, you know, those institutions are in some ways validated because these arguments have been rejected, mm-hmm. Because they were rejected by Mike Pence. I think what January 6th does kind of indicate to us is the degree of polarization in the public, the willingness of people on one side in this case or the other, potentially in the future, to breed and to believe in these, you know, theories about the Constitution or about, you know, what happened in the state that are really outside of what people who are knowledgeable about this or people who are exposed to mainstream views about these things think, right? There were very few people who thought after the states met in the Electoral College in December that there was any question about what would happen, right? Even after the absentee ballot moved in Pennsylvania and Georgia and indicated that Joe Biden was going to win those states, it was pretty much over. This idea that it's not over until the person is actually inaugurated on January 20th, I think that was that was not something that anyone really thought at this stage.
Some states have enacted new laws, too, in the aftermath of the 2020 election. Georgia, for example, there are fears from some critics of these new voting laws that they could be used to take over county election boards. I'm wondering which of these laws you're kind of paying particular attention to see how they actually work in real life, you know, once we hit the next set of elections.
Yeah. I think, you know, when you see Georgia's law allowing the state effectively to take over the county election board and to implement those procedures, that is one to look at. I think anything that limits in large metropolitan populations the ability of people to do absentee balloting or to vote, you know, to turn in their ballots, something where we might see long lines, for instance, that's problematic as well. Or overly aggressive efforts to purge voter rolls, you know, those are all areas where you could see influence in the election. On the other hand, even in those places like Georgia, we do see a lot of early voting, mm-hmm. and there is much more transparency about who is on the voter rolls, who is being eliminated from the voter rolls than would have been the case in the past. I think one thing that the listeners and the public can be optimistic about from the perspective of voting is that there is a much larger group of lawyers and interest groups and experts who are interested in these decisions and who are going to follow them and who are going to make sure that they're litigated in the courts, as opposed to being simply the decisions of individual politicians. It's very difficult, I think, in today's legal climate and today's political climate, to just knock a bunch of voters off the rolls, and especially to knock them off the rolls for partisan purposes or for no good purpose.
You alluded to this, or you hinted at a little bit at the start of our conversation, talking about what may come out of the Select Committee panel inquiry. But I'm wondering, what do you see as sort of emerging from that substantively? I know they have hearings scheduled to start fairly soon, public hearings on that. So what are you expecting to come out of that panel?
I think we've already seen, some of the indications of who was involved in this. And there have been, some of the text messages from Mark Meadows, I think, were, indicated the reaction to this, the former president's inaction during that time, I think is something that has been, amply demonstrated by this. I think the January 6th committee, however, they run the danger that they are, time is slipping away from them. The likelihood is high that Republicans will take over Congress in the next election. And so all of the, legal challenges, provided that they are not disposed of in the next, 11 months or so, what those will result in is a new Congress will come along, Republican Congress, Republican House, at least, and they will put an end to these inquiries. And so I think the problem for the January 6th committee is that because what they're dealing with is complicated by these questions of executive privilege and attorney-client privilege, and as we saw in these recent revelations about Sean Hannity, First Amendment protection for journalists, unless the judicial system, unless the Supreme Court is willing to quickly deal with these questions and these materials, it's unlikely that we'll see some of the major players, the Rudy Giulianis and Roger Stones potentially and so forth, brought before Congress and forced to either answer questions or take the Fifth Amendment, or to supply a lot of these documents that could potentially be of interest to the January 6th committee. When you look at congressional investigating committees in recent times, I think one of the most notable exercises of investigation was the Republicans who were investigating Benghazi, mm-hmm. right, because they were able to go at it for a very long period of time, and slowly they were able to issue requests that eventually got them to the Hillary Clinton email server, which was used to great effect by the Republicans in 2016. That was a four-year investigation that allowed them to do that. And the Democrats and, the Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, who are, in this committee, they're dealing with much less time and a much greater level of opposition from the people that they're investigating.
Finally, John, I just wanted to ask you, do you feel like the United States is more or less divided politically and I guess socially than it was on January 6, 2021?
I think that those divisions are continually changing. I think clearly there is a portion of the electorate to the degree that they're very interested in politics that have embraced these theories about an election being stolen or there not being a legitimate president or what have you. And that is one element of division. For many other people for whom politics is not an important part of their lives, life goes on. And I think one of the things that we've seen over the last couple of years when we look at politics generally is that divisions over such things as schools opening and responses to coronavirus restrictions, you know, policy around race. And, you know, in particular in the state of Florida, right, we saw a Latino population moving considerably in the Republican direction in the 2020 election. So I think one of the things that's come out of the Trump administration is an electorate that is divided. Yes, it's more divided by politics perhaps than it was in the past, but some of the divisions by gender, by race, have actually diminished from 2016 and from 2012 to 2020. And so the electorate is continually in this process of change. And I think given the changes to the economy, given a lot of the other social changes that we're seeing out there, it's an interesting question where we're going to end up in 2022 or 2024.
Well, Dr. John Hanley lectures in political science at the University of Central Florida. Thanks so much for your insights and thanks for your time.
Thank you, Matthew.